It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. Today it's the side of Japanese food few outsiders know. It's called washoku, home food. Our guest, Japanese culinary scholar Elizabeth Andow, explains washoku is the philosophical and spiritual heart of how Japan eats. The Stearns talk the cattlemen's in Oklahoma City, where you can get the whole steer from the horns to all parts south. Our bargain-hunting wine maverick Joshua Wesson has How Low Can You Go, Part 2. Seattle chef Thierry Rotureau brings us Kitchen Zen, a peaceful step-by-step guide to a showstopper dish. Then it's grad students playing on our hedonism, the bacon lover's alarm clock. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Japanese culinary scholar Elizabeth Andow talking about the little-known heart of Japanese cuisine. It's called washoku, a philosophical and practical concept of possibilities and transformations. Her book is Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Home Kitchen. Now, we had a ton of email when wine expert Josh Wesson did How Low Can You Go? His picks of really great cheap wine. Well, he is back now with How Low Can You Go Part Deux. Seattle chef Thierry Rotureau brings us cooking for sport. Think kitchen zen. One great dish built step by step. Then it's a new alarm clock operating on the pleasure principle. All you need is a pound of bacon. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's break out with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, it's pretty rare to find a great steakhouse that is open for three meals a day. But there is one, and it's one of the greats. It's in Oklahoma City, surrounded by the stockyards, and it is open at 6 a.m. every morning so the people who really work in the cattle business can come and have breakfast of bacon and eggs, sausage and eggs, ham and eggs, or brains and eggs.
Or my favorite of all, chicken fried steak and eggs, which is one of their specialties.
Oh, I love chicken fried.
Don't you just love it?
And this is a good one.
CFS, as the insiders call it.
Back up, though. They do brains?
Oh, yes. Brains and eggs is on the breakfast menu every day. Well, this is a place for cattlemen to eat. They not only have brains, one of the other specialties of the house is Rocky Mountain oysters, or they call them lamb fries there, which, of course, are gonads. And you can get these, like, sort of deep-fried as an appetizer with cocktail sauce on the side, or they're used also in one of the house specialties, a wonderful specialty that is called steak soup. It's kind of a lusty, mahogany brown soup, just crowded with vegetables, beef, and little pieces of lamb fry.
My favorite thing about, well, no, I can't say my favorite thing, because my favorite thing is the steak and the chicken fried steak. The atmosphere in this place is so phenomenal. They have murals. Now, how to explain this?
Backlit, illuminated photographic murals.
Of cows and cowboys from the 1950s. I mean, these murals have been there since.
The kind you mean.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Where the light, they kind of glow, and they're photographed. They're like wall-sized photographs.
Yeah.
There's one in the main dining room that's this huge herd of black Angus cattle with a bunch of guys kind of riding among them. But these are not like typical cowboys. These are more the kind of ranch owners. These are not buckaroos. These are guys wearing suits and ties. I mean, these are the kind of guys who can afford to eat a blue ribbon steak
so
when the day is done.
So they put them on the murals to say, these guys eat here.
That's right.
Yeah, these are cattlemen, not cowboys. And there is a difference. I mean, the cowboys are the working hands. The cattlemen, which, you know, believe me, I'm sure they work, you know, rough and tough jobs also. They're the owners of the stock. They're the ones who bring the cattle to market and sell it. So I guess this is a swanky place, but as Michael said, it's open for breakfast, and it doesn't have that snooty atmosphere.
Not in the least. And the fact is, you can spend, you know, you can go there and have a hamburger for lunch, and boy, is it a good hamburger, for I think $5 or $6. On the other hand, you can go there for dinner and spend $25 on a sirloin steak that is the equal to any you will find in New York, Chicago, Omaha, or Kansas City.
And Cattleman is on, it's on South Agnew Street, and that's right in the heart of the stockyards. Mm-hmm. And across from there is the most wonderful cowboy hat place. It's called Shorty's Cowboy. There's also boot makers and saddle makers and western shirt makers. So you can just kind of walk around that area, and outfit yourself like you're in City Slickers or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You can be a real dude and everyone can laugh at you.
The steaks sound great. Hey, guys, thanks.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I'm dressing up in style for in a little while. I'm going to ride into town. For every cowboy pal I know will lift his heel and toe when payday rolls around. And so I'm feeling fine because there's lots of time before we're all homeward bound. You work and slave with cattle, sweat and swear and battle until payday rolls around.
What does a cowboy do?
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I've just begun experimenting with grass-fed beef, seeing how it cooks and how it tastes. Now, so far, I've only tried the meat I found in my local market. My main reasons for buying the beef were to support local sustainable agriculture and for health claims. Grass-fed meat is supposed to have more of the healthy fat, you know, the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, I'd like to try more sources, but this is what I've found so far. This is lean beef. I mean, you really chew this one. And also, it needs slow cooking. And the steak should be kept medium rare or less. I mean, there's not much of that rock'em sock'em beef taste that you get from the usual beef. But I kind of like the gentle flavors. And maybe it's my imagination, no doubt it is. But I think grass-fed beef tastes green in the sense of that kind of fresh-cut grass smell transformed into a flavor. Now, I found that when I gave the steak a boost, maybe an hour in a bath of soy and wine and brown sugar and garlic, and then pan-grilled it really slow, it was utterly delicious. So see if there's grass-fed beef in your store and check it out. And remember, every single source is going to taste different. It's a matter of terroir. Enough for Josh Wesson to win awards as a sommelier or to co-author a now cult book, Red Wine with Fish. No, Josh had to leave behind bottles priced at three figures and dedicate himself to tracking down great sipping for modest money for his bestseller's wine shop and for us. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Josh, we have gotten more email on a piece we did with you a while back called How Low Can You Go? Really cheap wine. And, you know, I'm figuring that now with the price of oil, I would love if you could do the sun of How Low Can You Go? Have you got more picks for us?
Oh, of course. You know, I mean, I don't spend a lot of money on wine. My stores are all about cheap wine, so I can go pretty darn low, let me tell you.
Okay, do the cheap stuff for us, all right? What picks?
You know, let's go cheap. You should never say cheap.
You're right. I know.
Just say inexpensive.
All right.
Well, you know, I've been using the Starbucks latte index, which is no wine here that would cost more than a venti latte at Starbucks. So I'm capping everything. I will tell you this. There is a lot of inexpensive wine to be had at $6 or less that is absolutely delicious. You just got to hunt for it, know where to look, and know what not to drink as much as know what to drink.
Well, okay, let's start with what to drink, and then maybe you can tell us what to avoid.
Well, I think the last time we got together, all the noise was about Charles Shaw's two-buck chuck, and that stuff that Trader Joe's sells. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it was okay, and it still hasn't changed in price. The grape glut has diminished somewhat, so there's not that much juice sitting in a lake waiting to be put in a bottle in California or Chile or anywhere else. But I had some Charles Shaw Shiraz, which is a relatively new bottling for them. And that's where the action is. If you're drinking Chuck Shaw, if you have to go to Trader Joe's and you want to buy a $2 right. bottle of wine, skip their Merlot and Cab and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and go straight for the Shiraz. It's a winner. It's a stunningly good bottle of wine for $2, which is $3 outside of California, but it's still a winner at $3. I just can't say. Get a bendy straw and have a blast.
No. Put it in the decanter and put it out for a fancy dinner party.
You could fool people with that wine. You could could also fool people if you happen to be wandering the aisles of Trader Joe's and you want a Chardonnay, go for the La Boca, the B-O-C-A. It's from Argentina, from the Mendoza, famous place for making wine. And that goes for all of $3 a bottle. So it's 50% more than the Chuck Shaw stuff, but it's delicious. No oak, very fresh, yummy, super good wine for $3.
Okay, so let's say we don't have a Trader Joe's in our neighborhood. What to look for?
There are some great wines coming from Spain, made from a grape Tempranillo, which is the famous grape that goes into Rioja.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite right now for about $6, sometimes you can find it for as low as $5, is Casa Solar, S-O-L-A-R. It comes from the middle of Spain. And you want to get the youngest wine possible. In this case, it's about 2003.
Mm-hmm.
For a vintage. You might find some 2002, but get the youngest vintage possible with any inexpensive wine. When you're dealing in $2, $3, $4, $5, you know, age is not a virtue here. You want to go young. And Casa Solar is fabulous. And if you want to high on over to another part of the wine world, you're looking, let's say, down in Argentina, the Viu Manent, V-I-U-M-A-N-E-N-T, and make a really wonderful Malbec, which is a famous grape from Argentina.
And a red, like the Tempranillo, right?
Like the Tempranillo,
yeah.
Stunning little wine. And I just happened to trip over a port. An actual fortified wine that didn't have a screw cap on it. It didn't come in a bag. This is from Australia, which is a, you know, known producer of high-quality port-style wines.
Yeah.
It's made by Willow Glen, and they make a wonderful non-vintage port, simple, tawny port for about $6. And it's just great. But let's say you want to start a meal with some bubbly, and you don't want to drink André or Cold Duck or anything else that'll you know, cause permanent damage. You can go to a wine called Barefoot Bubbly, and it's made by Davis Bynum, Barefoot Bubbly, and it's California non-vintage sparkling wine, and it's $6, maybe $7 tops, and it is just a really happy glass of fizz. I can't think of a better way, you know, when I invite all my my college friends over to celebrate the fact that they still have hair.
Okay, Josh, though. Now, what should we avoid?
Avoid wines that are older than 3 years, because I guarantee if they're selling for $6, $7 or less and they're older than 3 years, they're going to be undrinkable or teetering on the edge of undrinkable.
Uh-huh.
And I would say, stay away at this point from really inexpensive box wines. There are some good ones. Something called block wine, which you can find in grocery stores, and it contains 2 bottles, and they go for about $5 a bottle, so it's $10
mm-hmm,
for this block.
Mm-hmm.
Really good. They make a wonderful Cabernet and a wonderful Chardonnay. But if you get in the $6, $7 price point and it's got a spout on it, I would run.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is co-founder of Bestsellers Wine Shop. Now, so that you do not have to miss a beat, we have put Josh's bargain wine picks up on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week you get a quick recipe and some shopping and technique tips. And best of all, Weeknight Kitchen's free. So sign up, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Washoku, the key to eating in Japan, and your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Whenever I think of Japanese food authority Elizabeth Andow's work, words like literate and thoughtful come to mind. It's been said no American knows Japan's cuisines the way Elizabeth does. Now, she went there in 1967 as a student. She married into a Japanese family and gradually became a scholar of foods and traditions. Her cookbooks became those references you want to hang on to. Well, her latest one digs into a little known, at least to foreigners, foundation of Japan's foodways, the bedrock of how Japan eats. The book is named for the tradition. It is Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Home Kitchen. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hello.
You know, I think for us, Elizabeth, Japanese food looks so complex. Is Washoku the heart of this?
It is, and it can be at all levels of complexity. Sometimes you want things very simple, and other times you enjoy sort of the fabrication, the glorification of things.
What exactly is this?
Washoku is really two things at the same time. It's a culinary philosophy, and then it's the food that's produced when you're in that mindset or in that spirit of the culinary philosophy. It refers to balance. The wa of washoku has, in its turn, two meanings. One is harmony, and it is the harmony of food, literally. And the other is it's reserved in the Japanese language for things that are indigenous or indicative of Japan, to set them apart from things that are foreign or acquired later. So it's the indigenous food and it's harmonious food.
What about the shoku?
The shoku means anything that's comestible, anything that you can ingest.
I see.
It's anything that can be eaten.
So what, this is home food. When a Japanese family sits down to eat, what would be an expression of washoku? What would be typical?
Well, there's not meaning to go heavy into Japanese vocabulary, but it's often very telling. The word gohan, which means a meal, also means rice, cooked rice. And as an essential element or component of a meal, you've got your cooked rice. You typically have a broth, shiru, that's accompanying it, and some other small, usually condiment-like dish. Tsukemono is what it's called in Japanese, the transformed food, or usually pickled, something not always tart, but often. And that becomes sort of the basic triumvirate of a meal. Things are built around it, and there are guidelines for washoku that help you achieve the harmony that the name implies. Part of that has to do with color. There are five colors. Part of it has to do with the ways in which the food are transformed. The word cooking is a little misleading because it implies the application of heat. And one of those ways of transforming food actually is nama, or raw, although with the raw movement one presumes that America's getting used to the idea that you don't have to apply heat. You have five tastes, so that you've got a variety of flavors going on. At some point, all of your senses, all five of them, are being engaged, not just smell, not just taste. I think perhaps one of the unique elements of Japanese cuisine is that sound is also a large part of it. Not only the sound of food as you're actually eating it, but also the sound of the food against the plate or in the dish at the same time.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It's a very sensory kind of experience to eat. And then there is the philosophic component, of which perhaps appreciation, kansha, is the most significant element. I know that a lot of cultures, many if not all, in some way acknowledge a higher being, saying grace at table, usually before eating, perhaps also at the conclusion of a meal. And in Japan, certainly there's a word that one says when you sit down to eat, itadakimasu. And it's a verb. It means to receive or to get. And it does indicate that the source is more exalted than you are. The language is very filled with honorifics and various levels. People are not on an equal plane when they're speaking Japanese. And that's both the fun and the challenge of it all. Mm-hmm. But more than that is this kansha, the sense of appreciation towards nature for having provided for the food, and people for being clever enough to figure out what to do with it, to transform it.
Far deeper sense of what is happening to that, whatever that food is.
Well, it's the potential that lies therein, and there are many different ways of realizing that potential. And some of it doesn't really require a whole lot of change. It just requires a set of choices about how you're going to change it and how it will be juxtaposed against something else. It is the sum total, it's the integration of all of these things that really make for harmony at table. It's not just one thing. It's one thing in combination or in conjunction with other things that are going on.
Now, this sounds in many ways to those of us who are not from the culture very complicated to be considering as you're, you know, coming home from work and pulling together dinner. But you do something in the book that's rather interesting. You put together a meal following these principles with non-Japanese ingredients. Could you give us an example?
Sure. Yesterday lunch, a tuna fish sandwich. Well, there are the five colors, the five flavors, and the five ways is your very basic sort of guidelines for helping you organize food. So in terms of color, black and white, sort of a backdrop, and then you've got red, yellow, and green. And already with the bread that I would choose for my sandwich, is it going to be white bread? Is it going to be whole wheat? The whole wheat would probably fall, especially if it were pumpernickel or something of that sort, it would fall into the category of black rather than white. But let's say I did decide to go with white bread because I just sort of wanted a backdrop. I didn't want something distinctive. Then I might be missing something black. Well, maybe putting an olive on the plate would help bring that into harmony, not only visually, but when you consider the nutritional components of all of those foods, you're probably filling in some of those missing blanks. Something green, the parsley that sits on your plate, it can have a nutritional purpose. It's a bit bitter. It could help alleviate the heavy salty or sweet or sour flavors. Certainly the choice of whether you would choose a lemon or a lime that was going to accompany it or perhaps be squeezed over it. All of these things are sort of considerations. They're out there. It's not necessarily a set of rules that have to be followed. But as you're assembling your plate, already I can realize in my mind I'm missing something red. Well, there's the slice of the tomato that's just going to finish the sandwich. It also has the sour element that perhaps I would not have had. I would call it mindfulness. Being mindful of the opportunity to assort in a particular kind of way. And it really does become second nature quite quickly.
Fascinating. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Andow is author of Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Home Kitchen. Her culinary arts center in Tokyo is called A Taste of Culture. Now, you can find Elizabeth's recipe for fried eggplant with crushed green soybeans on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, there are so many ways to approach cooking. For me, mostly it's seat-of-the-pants cooking, you know, tossing together dinner every night. It's fun, but the goal is to sit down and relax over some decent food as soon as possible. Then there is kitchen zen, when the act of cooking is nearly more pleasurable than the eating. Now, I'm talking about that wonderful concentration of building an important dish, maybe a restaurant dish, one that demands all your focus. It can be better than meditation. Well, Chef Thierry Rotureau's book started this train of thought. Thierry is chef owner of Seattle's near legendary restaurant, Rovers. His book is Rovers, Recipes from Seattle's Chef in the Hat. Hey, Thierry, it's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Lynn.
Now, Thierry, I've always meant to ask you this. What's with the hat?
What's with the hat?
Yeah, well, why the hat?
Got me a hat for Christmas about 5 years ago. And I took a very big liking to it. I was wearing it in the kitchen. One day I came out in the dining room. One of my favorite customers was there looking at me, and he goes, oh, the chef in the hat. And I went, oops, marketing, marketing, marketing. I got to keep that.
Well, this is what I'd like to do with you. I would like you to walk us through a real showstopper dish. You know, that kind of dish that does take time, that you do in many steps, but that delivers something extraordinary. And one of the ones from the book that I think is great because we can easily get most of the ingredients is the butter poached scallops on celeriac with Meyer lemonage and lemon confit. I mean, it just sounds like this unctuous, lovely.
It is a very unctuous, and it is also bright and yet very salon.
What does it actually taste like?
It tastes like, well, if you imagine the light flavor of celeriac, so light flavors of celery.
Right, because
a little bite to it created by the celery and the lemon that is added.
Mm-hmm.
And the scallop, of course, has this beautiful kind of light lobster texture and flavor. And also the lemon confit, which is something that we created here by cooking slices of lemon very thin and very slowly in a sugar and rice wine vinegar broth.
Right.
And very slowly for a couple of hours. And then you end up with a very translucent, slightly colored slice of lemon that is totally melting in your mouth.
Ooh.
And then, so that the great thing about that dish is you can do that a day or two before, because that will keep very well.
Now, tell me something. What's a nage?
A nage is a stock that is reduced down to extract flavor, but that is not down to a sauce, which is not thickened.
Now, that's something that's pretty easy to do when you think about it. You can do that with any broth you have in the house, really.
That is correct. The most important part is before you start reducing is to put your stock through a fine napkin or cloth, something that you've rinsed off so you don't have any soapy agent in there.
Uh-huh.
You put it in a colander,
right.
And then you pour your stock through it, and it's going to take a while. But what you will end up with is a very pure stock that will have no impurities. So now the reduction won't get any bitterness, funky taste. It will be pure. So what you're doing from now on is extract the flavor and intensify the flavor.
That's an interesting trick. So can I do the puree of the celeriac ahead?
Absolutely.
And that's the bulb. That's that bulb you see in the supermarket.
The big round white kind of fuzzy roots on it. It looks something from another planet sometimes.
Yes, exactly. A meteorite.
Once you peel that thick layers of skin, you'll end up with a white core inside. And try to take all the black spot out, all the dark spot. It's got to be white pure meat. Cut that in big cubes like if you were making mashed potato and cook the celeriac that way. Then once it's cooked, you press it really hard so you extract as much water as possible from it. And then you put it in a food processor and just blend it really hard. Now, you can finish that with olive oil if you don't want to do too much fat. My favorite is to do reduced cream and butter in a pan. And put
Yeah, that would be my favorite too. I think so, yeah.
So now we have the puree of celeriac and we have the confit of lemon. And then the rest is... basically, you take some fish stock or some lobster stock.
Right.
Then you
And you can buy fish stock in fish stores and even in supermarkets. Yeah.
Again, remember, try to strain it through that cloth. You reduce down that stock, and then you whisk in some butter into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you poach your scallop into that. So poaching meaning then there is no boiling involved. It's slightly below boiling point. Because if it boils, your scallop are going to get tough.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to do a gentle cooking method. And the beautiful thing about having a butter lemon nage will be the fact that your fish will be totally silky, and it's a very, very nice methods of cooking for fish.
Right.
Once it's done, you take out the scallops, you reduce down a little bit the stock, try not to boil it too hard and whisk the whole time because otherwise it will separate.
Mm-hmm.
And then put in your lemon. And the reason I put the lemon juice at the end is mainly because my lemon, to me, if you put it at the beginning, you kind of distort the flavor of the lemon.
I think that's true of even fresh, normal fresh lemons, which you could, you say in this recipe, you could use fresh lemons if you
can't. Right, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you put the lemon at the end, and you basically serve the whole thing in a bowl. You put the puree of celeriac on the bottom. You put your scallop right around it or on top. And then you put your broth all around it. And your Mayo lemon sliced confit that you've warmed up just on top of the scallop.
Ooh.
And it's a yummy dish.
Yummy. Highly technical term, but it really applies. Hey, Thierry, this sounds so fabulous. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome, Lynn.
Thierry Rotureau is chef owner of Rover's Restaurant in Seattle. His new book is Rover's Recipes from Seattle's Chef in the Hat. Now, you'll find Thierry's recipe for, gotta take a deep breath on this one, butter poached scallops in celeriac puree with Meyer lemon nage and lemon confit on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's finally happened. I found my dream refrigerator. Wired magazine had a piece on it. Now, most fridge gimmicks do not move me. You know, multiple doors, little teeny drawers, forget it. They're a waste as far as I'm concerned. But this model has exactly what I want. Most important, I don't know about you guys, I stuff my refrigerator. I've never had a refrigeration space that's quite big enough because we're into vegetables and all that stuff. And things always freeze at the back of my fridge. And this has to do with air circulation. This refrigerator does not allow that to happen. It evidently has the ultimate in air circulation. It has a microprocessor that controls temperatures, and every part of the fridge can actually have a different temperature and a different humidity setting within 1 degree, and it will hold that. This is what I want in a refrigerator. The other thing is that it's highly sensitized to humidity and temperature, so you don't have variances. Even if you put, you know, that pot of broth you want to cool down really fast and you think everything in the refrigerator is going to warm up, evidently the way this fridge works, it counteracts that with extra cold. You can't warm up everything else. It has a door that beeps if it's open too long. It seals absolutely tight. And it's glass, so you can gaze before you graze. So you're not going to stand with the refrigerator door open costing you money. And it's incredibly energy efficient. All this is done with less energy than goes into a 100-watt bulb. So this is my dream. The refrigerator is Sub-Zero's Pro 48. That's the model. There's only one hitch. You save a lot of money on energy, but you have to have $12,000 to get it into your house. It's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this one is inspired by talking about how in Japan, rice is the foundation of the meal. Now, the question is, what does soaking rice before cooking do for your soul, at least according to a bit of Japanese folklore? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment. And we're going to hear about an alarm clock for bacon lovers. And we will be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, according to Japanese folklore, what does soaking rice before cooking do for your soul? Well, in Japan, rice has so many beliefs and myths attached to it. One is that soaking rice before cooking releases life energy, and another says that it brings peace to the soul of the eater. Of course, there is the great faux pas in rice etiquette. Never stand up your chopsticks in a bowl of rice. It's a symbol of death, of a tombstone. And finally, there's the one way Japanese moms get their kids to finish their rice. They tell them each grain is a little Buddha.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around. If it seems your friends desert you, there's somebody thinking of you. I'm the one who never hurt you. Maybe it's because I love you.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, tomatoes true to nature. So pick up that phone, guys. Number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the lines. We have got Brad calling from Boise, Idaho. Hey, Brad, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about cheese, Lynn.
Oh, okay, okay.
I love cheese. I'm a big cheese fan. All kinds, sharp, soft, hard, you name it.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, about, you know, every time I go to the store and I look at the variety of exotic cheeses from everywhere, it'd be sure great to be able to make some myself.
Oh, yeah. Cheese making is great fun.
But I start talking to friends of mine, it'd be great to make cheese, and they're like, oh, no, you have to get some non-homogenized milk to be able to make cheese, and, of course, you can't buy that from anybody except unless you own a cow.
This is like, you know, there are certain cuts of meat that you want to say start with the steer. Now, you can make cheese from pasteurized milk. And it may not be quite the same as that raw milk, carefully aged in only one cave in France cheese that you love.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, you can make cheese from pasteurized milk. I like to use organic milk, I don't know, just because I believe it tastes better, and also I think it's just better all around for me and whatever. But the point is that you don't have to have raw milk. And a couple of things you should know, first of all. Most important thing is to work with either stainless steel or glass containers. Nothing aluminum, nothing that's going to, or iron, because that can give off a flavor to the milk or the cheese. The other thing you want to do is make sure things are scrupulously clean, sterilized. So you wouldn't take, and you're going to need an instant reading thermometer that ranges from somewhere around, let's say, 60 degrees up to maybe 200 degrees. And that's a case, too, where you want to just dip it in boiling water every time you go to stick it in the milk to get a temperature. There's a couple of places that have cheese-making kits that are really helpful, because the basic thing with cheese is that you are using an acid or a culture, okay, to separate the liquid of the milk from the solid of the milk, as in the whey, which is the liquid, and the curds. You know, Little Miss Muffet stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the curds become cheese. Now, depending on, you can do that just with lemon juice and make, you know, ricotta or cottage cheese. Really simple stuff. But if you want to get fancy, you use different cultures. These are different bacteria that will produce different styles of cheese as you go through that process. So the cheese, the culture that's used to produce a cheddar is different than a culture that might be used to produce, let's say, a brie. You see? But there are places where you can get all that information, and there are books on it. And one place, we've had this woman on the air a long time ago, but it's still thriving. There's a site. I think it's a site. I know it's a catalog. The New England Cheese Making something. It's New England Cheesemakers or New England Cheesemaking. And I know that they've got books on the subject. They have starter kits. And I've used their stuff, and it really works like a charm. I mean, there's a ton of stuff you're going to find on the web, but I'd say that's a really great place to start because they've been around for donkey's years.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I haven't overloaded you.
Oh, no, this is a good starting.
Yeah, start with cream cheese or cottage cheese or ricotta because those are the easy ones, and you're going to be, oh, when you make homemade cream cheese, you're going to eat the whole thing. It's so good.
Now my wife won't be quite so scared about this venture.
No. Just remember, everything has to be absolutely pristinely clean.
Okay.
And follow those directions about temperatures because it's really important. And if you do that, you're going to be fine.
Great. I'm looking forward to the cheese.
And when you win your first award for your homemade cheese, you will tell everyone that it all started when the Splendid Table gave you advice.
I will.
Okay, Brad. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
Homemade cheese is really great to do, especially the simple ones. I mean, they like, you know, as I mentioned, the cottage cheese, the fresh cheeses. They go very quickly, and they are so good. Good. And you learn so much from the process. Call us, 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. We have got Kurt calling from Minneapolis. Kurt, what's up? What are we going to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. Over the holidays, Christmas particular, I decided to go old school and roast a goose.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It wasn't, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah, I overcooked it a bit, and what little meat we could get from it was about as dry as sandpaper.
Oh,
so.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, it's the thing that's always stunning to me about a goose is how little meat there is there.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah. I mean, it's almost as bad as a duck.
Yeah, but, exactly.
but I made a great soup out of it with about 6 heads of garlic and a good shot of vinegar in it.
Sounds fabulous.
But what the gold that was left was, it seemed that all the flavor, all the goodness of the turkey was left me about 4 cups of this goose fat.
Oh.
And I strained it, and I said, okay, this is cooking gold.
You got it.
I don't want to waste it on something basic. I mean,
I understand. No, I know what you
mean.
It's
been sitting in my freezer for about 4 weeks.
I hear you. This is gold, and you don't want to waste it where it's not going to be tasted.
Exactly.
So you don't want to put it in a really complex dish with a dozen different ingredients or a lot of spices.
Thank you.
The great classic thing that you do with goose fat is you slice potatoes and you pan saute them and crusty them up in goose fat.
Okay.
And that is one of the most wonderful, you know, this is died and gone to heaven food. The same thing, by the way, with cabbage, you know, doing a classic sweet sour cabbage where you brown the cabbage with onions in the goose fat. And then you add just what you did with the soup. You add a bit of vinegar and a bit of sugar and caraway seed and you let that cook. And it's so succulent. You want the cabbage almost melting by the time it's done.
Okay.
And it's silky from just cooking in its own juices and the onion and that luscious goose fat.
What proportion of goose fat should I use? I mean, I don't want to put the whole thing in.
No. And you also don't want it so fatty that you're eating spoonfuls of goose fat. Let's say you've got
definitely.
A medium head of cabbage. You've got a 12-inch straight-sided sauté pan. You want about 4 to 5 tablespoons of the goose fat. You melt it. And then for that medium cabbage that you chop up, you want a nice-sized medium onion that you chop up, too, and you'd have a bit of garlic.
Good.
And that would be – and what you would do is you'd warm the goose fat, get the goose fat fairly hot. You'd throw in the cabbage and the onion, and you'd really try to brown it in that mixture. Medium-high heat, take your time. Then you splash in the vinegar and a bit of sugar. And you may want to add a little bit of broth or liquid of some kind. You could even add water. And, of course, the caraway seeds and salt and pepper. But the idea is you really want to cover it and let it be almost smothered in its own juices and, of course, the bit of fat.
Okay.
So you get that really pure, intense flavor. You could do broccoli.
Oh, perfect.
In it. You could do cauliflower. Fennel is wonderful done.
Okay.
So you see what I'm saying? You could do the stuff that's very low in calories and doesn't have any carbs.
Yeah, pick the vegetables that are not really over the top and then just kind of simmer them for a while.
Exactly, and let them cook until they're silky in the juices and then in that bit of fat. And then, of course, the classic thing that you can do is a confit. Now, that's where it's an old method of preserving duck and goose. And that's where you actually, you cut up the duck or the goose. I guess you don't want to go near a goose again. Besides that, too big.
I'm not giving up on the goose yet.
But whatever. Yeah. You rub salt into it. And you can find recipes for this on the internet. Anything by Paula Wolfert, by the way.
Thank you.
The word confit and the name Paula Wolfert, you put that together and you will have a master's recipe for confit. But confit is a very old way of preserving duck and goose. And essentially what you do is you cure it a bit overnight in the fridge with salt and spices, and then you cook it in the fat until you can actually poke it with a straw and it'll go through the meat. And then what you do is you layer it in a crock or something that doesn't react, so it'd be glass or pottery. You layer a layer of the fat, a layer of the meat, a layer of the fat, a layer of the meat, so that it is completely covered with the fat. And then you can let it ripen. It can ripen for a couple of days, or it can ripen for literally a matter of months. You have to keep it cool. It has to have been well salted so that you draw out a lot of the juices that can cause problems later with bacteria. But this is one of the oldest methods of preserving, and it is unbelievable, because when you reheat the meat, you crisp that leg or breast, it's amazing. It's not greasy, but it's so delicious.
Okay, well, thanks for the help.
Hey, you are welcome. Enjoy.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Take care. 4 or 5 cups of goose fat? That's better than having stock. I mean stocks, as in stock market stocks. Anyway, 800-537-5252. You know those ads showing people waking up with a smile because they can smell the coffee? Well, being a true food snob and a devout night person, the usual stale-smelling canned coffee will not get me up at 9 a.m. or any hour before that. But there is a new contraption that could do it for me, the Waken Bacon. Now, we have one of its inventors on the phone. Maddie Salen is a NYU grad student. Maddie, welcome.
Pleased to be here.
Maddie, what is the Waken Bacon?
It's an alarm clock that wakes you up with bacon instead of with a alarm, basically.
How does it work? I mean, it's cooking the bacon?
Yeah, basically, you put a frozen strip of bacon in the clock the night before, and the next morning, it basically acts like an easy bake oven, and it slowly cooks the bacon over about 10 minutes with a pair of halogen bulbs. And then you wake up from the smell of it, which is pretty strong. And then you get to actually eat the bacon.
I love this. So is the idea here that we awake more readily to a pleasant aroma than we do to a jarring sound?
Yeah, I mean, we have to, in this modern age, we have to wake up every day of the work week. And this way, it's a pleasant way to wake up, and you're rewarded for waking up with bacon. And the idea is that it evokes that feeling when you're at home and you're a kid and mom's cooking something wonderful for breakfast.
So I could be baking a chocolate chip cookie if I chose.
Yeah, you could, actually.
How does this actually work? I mean, is this a toaster that is designed to take bacon? I mean, what does the physical thing look like?
Well, it actually looks, I actually designed it to look like a little pig face, and it has these nostrils, and the nostrils light up when it's cooking, and the aroma comes out of the nostrils. They're also the air holes, and so it looks like a pig, but you can put whatever you want to in it. The way that it works is that when it goes off, instead of going to a speaker and sounding a siren, it triggers a pair of halogen light bulbs. And both those bulbs are positioned right over where the bacon is, where the frozen bacon is, and it cooks the bacon in a little pan, and then it turns off after 10 minutes, and the bacon's fully cooked
this
and
is
crispy.
Great. What was the toughest part of putting this together?
The toughest part was dealing with bacon grease all the time and always having to, like, wash my hands and wash all my implements and everything. But everybody was very excited when I was working on this in the workshop because there was tons of test bacon for everybody to eat.
Are you going to actually market this? Is it going to be in the stores?
Well, it's funny. It was designed to be a novelty. I just had to satisfy an electronics assignment. I'm taking a class in electronics, and we had to make a device for the home.
Uh-huh.
And it's received so much attention now that people have started emailing me asking for one. So I guess if I can find some kind of manufacturer, then I'll go forward with it.
Well, when you do, let us know. Because
certainly.
Having a pig next to me in the bed and the bacon going, this is a very nice idea.
It's a great way to wake up, I have to tell you. Second best way to wake up.
Maddie, yes. Maddie, thanks.
My pleasure.
Maddie Salen is an NYU graduate student and one of the creators of Waken Bacon, the bacon alarm clock. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from astronaut Neil Armstrong. He said, "I believe every human has a finite number of heartbeats. I do not intend to waste any of mine running around doing exercise." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer, and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Recipes online at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Tomatoes, true to nature. Additional support comes from A.G. Edwards & Sons, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. A.G. Edwards, fully invested in their clients. And from gather.com, where you can read recipes and helpful hints from the Splendid Table. You can share your perspective at gather.com, online at gather.com. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell and Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julie Schrenkler, and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.